Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. We are here on Monday. It is April 15th, 2019. Happy Russell Wilson contract day. We will see. Might not be happy for Russell Wilson. Might not be happy if you are a Seattle Seahawks fan. We will see later in the week what happens to Russell Wilson. But we're not talking about Russell Wilson today. We are talking about two different teams with two very different situations. We're going to get to the Vikings and their strange offseason, for me at least in some ways, a little later on in the show. But joining me first to talk about the Arizona Cardinals and the very interesting opportunity they have coming up in the next couple of weeks with the first overall pick in their offseason, which, again, surprised me in a lot of ways. I'm going to talk to Josh Weinfuss of ESPN about that. Josh, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on. You, of course, cover the Cardinals for ESPN. Do a great job doing that. We have a very strange team here in Arizona. When you have the team that finished with the worst record in the previous year's draft, usually it is a sign that the team is going to rebuild. They're going to bring in a lot of younger talent, try to maximize their draft picks. And if they already have a young quarterback, they're not going to take another one. And the Cardinals seem to be approaching this in a very different direction from all of that. And we're going to get to the Kyler Murray, Josh Rosen situation in a moment. But just starting first with the Cardinals, starting with what happened last year with Steve Wilks, was there a moment where you felt like, you know, they were going to be a one and done with him as the head coach? Were you surprised when it happened?
I was not surprised when it happened. I didn't think it should have happened. I thought they should have given him at least 2 years, maybe even three, to try to figure out if he can right the ship. But the moment that I thought is that, you know, he could be a one and done was when they fired Mike McCoy. Because I had heard all along that he wasn't Steve Wilks' hire, that he came from the front office, that the GM Steve Keim wanted Mike McCoy in the building. And I feel like when you force a marriage like that, it's just not going to work. And then we saw how bad the offense was, starting with Sam Bradford, who, I mean, they got paid a lot of money, and he was just scared. He was scared of re-injuring his knee. And then by time week seven rolled around, I mean, this team was not very good. And we knew by then that it was going to be a lost season. And then they got blown out on Thursday Night Football by the Denver Broncos. I think it was 45-10. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you kind of knew, all right, this could be a one-and-done situation. Then they fired Mike McCoy the next morning, bring in, promote Byron Leftwich, who, you know, had some a little success under Bruce Arians, but he still was a pretty green offensive coordinator. And at that point, you're just like, all right, we have no idea what's going to happen the rest of the year. Josh Rosen was up and down, new coordinator, his second of the season. He was going to, you know, Leftwich's plan was to pare down the playbook, because one player told me that Mike McCoy had 293 plays on his call sheet every day of practice. That's an insane amount of plays to try to get through every day. So it was a mess all around. But I saw it coming, but I did not think Steve Wilks should have been fired after 1 year.
Oh, man. It's funny to think about that when you mentioned Mike McCoy's play sheet being 293 plays long, to think about Cliff Kingsbury's entire offensive playbook, which might be, I don't know, 30, 40 plays. Very interesting change.
Totally different.
Totally different in a lot of ways. A really interesting hire, of course. In terms of Steve Keim, I mean, are you surprised that he kept his job after the disappointing season?
Yes, very surprised, actually. After the day after they fired Steve Wilks, my story was that they fired the wrong guy. I felt they should have fired Steve Keim instead of Steve Wilks, simply because of how many mistakes he's made personnel-wise over the last, you know, 6 years. I feel like he got a lot of leeway because of the success they had in 13, 14, and 15 when Bruce Arians was here, and they went, you know, 10-6, 11-5, 13-3. In that 13-3 season, they went to the NFC Championship game where they lost to the Carolina Panthers. But from that, basically that loss on, Steve Keim has really struggled with draft picks, with free agency decisions. I mean, he let guys like Tyrann Mathieu go. First off, he signed Tyrann Mathieu to a huge deal when he was coming off an ACL injury, got another ACL injury, and then they let him go a couple years later. He let Calais Campbell walk, and the next year Calais Campbell has, I think it was 14 sacks for the Jacksonville Jaguars. So he made a lot of questionable decisions from the end of the 2015 season on, and I think that if this was any other organization, they would have fired their GM, because you had three consecutive seasons of 7-8-1, 8-8, and 3-13. by anybody's standards, that's not good enough to, you know, to keep a GM. So I was very surprised that he kept his job. I do know that Michael Bidwell, the Cardinals president, he kind of he embraces loyalty. And Steve Keim has been with the organization for 20-something years. He grew up in, you know, from in the team as a scout. Now obviously he's a GM, but I don't know if this happens again. I don't know how he keeps his job, because we, you know, and then it turns into a whole new situation of, if they get a new GM, does a GM want Cliff as his coach?
Right.
So this could just be, you know, a domino effect that could last years.
Yeah, it does seem like it could be a brutal cycle where it's just, you know, constantly just overturning things for the sake of overturning. A very similar situation to the Browns, maybe, you know, earlier or over the last 10 years or so before they kind of settled things over the last two seasons. I mean, you look at these drafts, you know, even going back through 2012 when was Keim officially appointed as GM?
2013,
excuse me. So 2013, 2012 draft was not great. Michael Floyd and Jamel Fleming were the first two picks. Floyd, you know, had the off-field issues. But 2013, Jonathan Cooper, Kevin Minter, the first two picks. Cooper never developed, never really became a favorite of Bruce Arians. Kevin Minter, a serviceable linebacker, but someone who moved on, came back. You know, a guy who, sorry, didn't come back, but a guy who was, you know, basically just a, you know, he's a average inside linebacker. 2014, the first two picks, Deion Buchanan, Troy Nicholas. Buchanan, you know, fell out of favor over the last year or so once they did bring in Wilkes and, of course, followed Arians out of town. 2015, DJ Humphries, Marcus Golden. Golden got hurt. They drafted David Johnson in the third round, but Humphries has never been healthy and never really been effective as a tackle. 2016, Robert Nkendiche, Brandon Williams. Nkendiche, again, a guy who's not developed, and Brandon Williams, who, you know, they had famously on the field in that Patriots game against Jimmy Garoppolo and got burnt, and then they haven't really trusted him to play cornerback ever since. 2017, Hassan Reddick and Buda Baker. Well, that's better. You know, that's promising, at least to some extent. In 2018, Christian Kirk was very good, but the number one, the 10th pick was Josh Rosen, a guy who, you know, they have major question marks about, and maybe they should, maybe they shouldn't. But because of all that, because they didn't hit on those picks, they went out and they had to spend a lot of money in free agency this offseason. They went out and before free agency even began, signed Charles Clay and Robert Alford, got a very big deal for a guy who really struggled for the Falcons last year. And then afterwards, Jordan Hicks, Terrell Suggs, Darius Vilon, Marcus Gilbert, J.R. Sweezy. I mean, are you surprised, number one, that they spent that much money? And number two, that ownership trusted Keim to spend all that money?
I'm not surprised they spent all that money, because that seems to, you know, be their MO the last years, trying to fix this team by free agency and trying to get some big quote-unquote big free agency signings. But if you know, the one thing that all those guys have in common, at least most of them, is that they've had major injuries in the last 2-3 years. So Steve Keim tries to get these guys on the cheap. That has been his, you know, his way of operating for as long as he's been a GM in Arizona. He tries to get cheap guys for 1 or 2 year deals. Obviously Alford was the exception in this case, but he tries to, you know, find a prove-it guy. You know, guys will want a one-year prove-it deal, come in, play well for Arizona, then move on. He doesn't, to me, it seems like, I know there are guys in the locker room who feel the same way, he doesn't want to spend the time to develop talent. And that just shows, I think, me and some of the players, that he just wants to try to get that one year, that one hit, and then move on to the next best thing. Well, you're not going to win many football games that way, and that's proven to be the case. And I'm not surprised that the front office has given him such leeway, because Michael Bidwell truly trusts what Steve Keim does. And it worked. And it worked very well for a few years. He had guys like Jonathan Abraham, who had a career year, Chris Johnson, who had some great seasons here. Dwight Freeney played well the year they went to the NFC Championship game. But then he's had so many swings and misses on older guys who've either gotten hurt. You know, a couple years ago, he brought in Evan Mathis. I don't think he lasted more than 2 or 3 games. It's just, you know, so we know how Steve Keim operates. We know he likes to spend money on guys he thinks can fit. Robert Alford is obviously a perfect example, coming off an ankle injury that bothered him all last year. He even said last week that he won, you know, he tried to play through it all year. I admire the toughness, but at the same time, what did that do for your ankle? And they needed him to fill a void that basically they drafted Brandon Williams for. Brandon Williams was a running back at Texas A&M. His first 3 years, converted to cornerback. They drafted him expecting him to be the corner of the future. Well, I mean, note to everybody, playing corner in the NFL is a very hard position. And if you haven't played it, you know, your whole life, it's very tough to transition to it and be elite, which is what they expected. So that corner position opposite Patrick Peterson has been a revolving door year in and year out, and that's what they hope Robert Alford can fix and fill. But, you know, I'm not surprised that the Cardinals said, you know, but Michael Bidwell basically told Steve Keim, go win. Because one thing we started seeing around midseason last year was that there were a lot of empty seats in the stadium. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the year, the stadium was a third full, maybe a quarter full. And Michael Bidwell wanted to win. He wanted to find the next Sean McVay. And he was very open about that. He wanted a young offensive mind, which is why they went out and hired Cliff Kingsbury. And he wanted to make sure all the pieces were in around him. So he basically, you know, from the looks of it, gave Steve Keim a blank check and said, let's try to win some games next year. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to bring in someone who is a young offensive mind, certainly Cliff Kingsbury qualifies. All right, Joshua, let's talk about what the Cardinals are going to do with the first overall pick here in a moment. But first, want to talk about our friends at SeatGeek. And I'm always talking about how I use SeatGeek, how I'm using it for the future. I use SeatGeek this very weekend. On Saturday, I was sitting around. I was talking to my partner. I said, hey, do you want to go to the Capitals game today? And she said, yes, I'd love to go to the Capitals game. I'm a big Capitals fan. What do you think we did? We went on SeatGeek on my phone, looked at tickets, got two tickets to the game. It was a very strange game, not going to lie. It was a little stressful, but it worked out great. The Capitals won. We were both excited, and we got a great deal because we used SeatGeek. And I use SeatGeek for every single time I'm looking for tickets to anything, whether it's sports, whether it is a concert, whether it is a Broadway show. I'm not going to lie. It's mostly sports. That's just me. But if you want to use it for other stuff, you absolutely should. Because you're going to get a great deal. You're going to get tickets that you can trust because you know that SeatGeek is going around to places that have authentic tickets. So they have a guarantee. So you know you're getting tickets you can actually use. And you are going to get a deal that fits your needs, whether it's the tickets in the front row or in our case, whether it is tickets perhaps closer to the last row. It does not matter. You can use SeatGeek to get whatever tickets you want for whatever event you want. And if you have not used SeatGeek previously, which is not me because I have used it many times, but if you've not used SeatGeek previously, you can use promo code Barnwell, my last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, for $10 off your first purchase today. You can use that for concert tickets, sports, comedy, whatever you want. That's promo code Barnwell for $10 off your first purchase at SeatGeek today. So on the SeatGeek app, on SeatGeek.com, at checkout, enter in promo code Barnwell for $10 off your first purchase today. Now back to the show. Cliff Kingsbury runs the air raid offense. He is someone who, you know, certainly wants a mobile quarterback to help the numbers and the running game, to help take some of the threat off the pass rush, to make plays when the protection does break down. And Josh Rosen is not that. And Kyler Murray, who was in a version of the air raid at Oklahoma under Lincoln Riley, certainly is that. He's obviously an incredibly mobile quarterback and a great athlete and a great quarterback in his own right. So that brings us to the first overall pick. I mean, where do you think the Cardinals currently stand? Obviously, it's been a process where it's felt more and more like their guy is Kyler Murray. Do you think that's changed at all over the past couple weeks?
No, I think it's actually, if anything, has gotten, you know, stronger that he's their guy. Mm-hmm. To me, there's been so much smoke that he's their guy, and the smoke is coming from so many different places that to some degree, I just think, you know, he has to be their guy. I think there's still a chance they trade the pick. I think Steve Keim is smart enough to see if there's a good offer on the table, mm-hmm. not to turn it down. And I think there are teams out there that might be willing to give him another one and a couple of picks maybe later in the draft or maybe next year. And I think if they see an opportunity to get a haul for the number one pick, mm-hmm. I think he'll do, because he understands he needs to build certain areas of this team out for the next few years. But I do think that Kyler Murray's a guy. I mean, does he need to be? I don't necessarily think so. I think Josh Rosen is athletic enough to get out of the pocket, to make some plays. And he showed that time and time again last year. Mm-hmm. I did a story a couple weeks ago where I looked at all the quarterbacks Cliff Kingsbury and Mike Leach had at Texas Tech. Not one of them was under 6'1". So the size thing, to me, people, I think it's become a narrative where people are saying this offense needs a mobile quarterback. It doesn't need a mobile quarterback. Cliff Kingsbury, 6'3", 6'4", he ran it. He was a pocket passer with the same type of athleticism as Josh Rosen, and he did just fine in it. He finished sixth in the Heisman Trophy voting in 2002. So you don't need a small quarterback who can move to make this work. It just seems like everyone wants that to be the case. But we do know that Cliff Kingsbury has a long relationship with Kyler Murray. He recruited him to Texas A&M back in 2012. So I think right now that's probably going to be the pick.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly, like you said, the smoke element of it is there. It seems like there something would have to happen. Like there would have to be a trade, or there would have to be a moment where we would hear, oh, well, this is why they don't like Kyler Murray, actually. And we haven't heard that yet, and we're so close to the draft that it just seems inevitable at this point. In terms of the, you know, if it's not Murray at one, do you think it is more likely that it's a trade as opposed to them drafting one of the defensive players who are sort of seen as the top players who aren't Kyler Murray in this year's draft?
Yeah, I do. I do think it'll be, if it's not Kyler, I think it's a trade. And then I think it's going to be probably, you know, Nick Bosa, Quinnen Williams, Josh Allen, one of those three. Yeah. But I do think the odds are higher that it's a trade than it is a defensive player. But then again, you know, I'm not going to call anything absolute this year. I think that there's still that small chance that Steve Kime and company could just have just totally taken us for a crazy ride for the last couple of months. This one massive smokescreen, and they end up drafting one of the defensive studs. So I do think that's a small possibility. I don't think it's likely, but I'm not going to rule it out at all.
Yeah, it does make sense that even if you end up taking one of the defensive players, which, by the way, isn't the end of the world by any means, if you get a, you know, a second franchise pass rusher to put next to Chandler Jones and someone who can learn behind Terrell Suggs, you know, there are worse things in the world than having a great pass rush by any means. But, you know, if you're the Cardinals and you have the number one pick, it makes sense for you to try and drum up that interest in Kyler Murray to try and say, okay, if you want to get this guy, you got to trade up to number one because we might take him number one. You know, I think that makes total sense. It's a really smart move if that's what they're doing. I don't know that it is or is not, but I think that's certainly, you know, it can be a little bit disruptive to Josh Rosen, of course, but it's well within the playbook in terms of how you would handle the first overall pick if you had it, no?
Oh, absolutely. And Steve Kime has said, you know, basically since he started drafting for the Cardinals in 2013, he has talked about his love of the smokescreen. You know, he's over the years in post-draft press conferences, he made jokes about, oh, yeah, you know, I told you this, but it was really this the whole time. Or, you know, even when Bruce Arians was here, the two of them would joke, oh, it's smokescreen season, that type of thing. So if you look back and kind of put the pieces together, it's not totally out of the realm of possibility. This is one massive smokescreen, and we're all just buying into it just because we, you know, because everyone is enthralled with Kyler Murray. Is he a great quarterback? Yes. Is he talented? Absolutely. Is he needed to run this offense and win football games? No. I think for the Cardinals, the biggest key will be fixing that defense. And I've been saying this for a long time now. The defense is so easy to fix. So you have guys like you said, Chandler Jones. You have Patrick Peterson, who takes away half the field immediately. Right. You fix that other cornerback, which apparently they're trying to do with Robert Alford. That frees up the other nine guys to just pin their ears back and go. You have a lot of talent. Hassan Reddick, one of the most athletic players in the NFL. He still has trouble grasping the defense, but he's very athletic to make plays. You know, they added DJ Swearinger, Buda Baker, who is a Pro Bowler. There are a lot of good pieces on defense where if you can just, you know, tweak it and get it back to what it was under Todd Bowles and James Fetcher, which was a top five, top 10 defense, then I think you can work on the offense for a year or two because you have such a great defense that can win games for you and let Josh Rosen develop, which I think is what they should do. Now, obviously, I'm not the GM here. It's, you know, Cliff Kingsbury feels comfortable with, you know, bringing in Kyler Murray and kind of, to me, disrupting this entire team, then that's what they're going to do.
Of course, yeah. I mean, absolutely. It seems like he, you know, certainly Kime is involved, but it seems like if that's what Cliff Kingsbury wants, it's what they're going to end up doing. In terms of Rosen, do you feel a sense of urgency from the organization to make a trade now? Do you think they're comfortable having these two guys, if they do draft Murray, having them on the roster through the summer and sort of approaching this as maybe a trade they make, in August when you might have a guy get injured, you have a guy who looks good in training camp, sort of that Sam Bradford, Teddy Bridgewater, trade era from years past?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell for a couple of reasons. First, I've been told by multiple people that if Rosen's traded, it's going to happen on draft day. So we have to keep our eyes open for that. The other part is, does this team really want to bring in two starting quarterbacks together for OTAs and minicamp, and maybe even into training camp? Because I think then you run the risk of fracturing a locker room. Because, you know, there are guys who really like Josh Rosen on this team. So what if you bring Kyler Murray and they go through, you know, camp together, they split all the drills, all the first team reps, whatever it may be, and all of a sudden half of the team is like, wow, Josh has really made some strides and you know, since his rookie year. We really like him. And the other half is like, well, this kid Kyler Murray is a real deal. Well, then once you trade Josh, you have half a team saying, well, Kyler's not that good. I prefer Josh. You have an unnecessary fracture in your team instead of just saying, this is our guy, this is who we're going with, got to live with it or leave. I think that they would be bringing in such an unnecessary headache by keeping two guys. Now, from a standpoint of trying to trade him, I get it. But I have a feeling they're going to try to move him either right before or on draft day, or at least by time the draft is over. And then I just said, just because I think it's too big of a risk to have two young starting quarterbacks on your team at the same time.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. You know, I think that it would be one thing if this were a guy who had years of success, you know, sort of similar, not maybe Bradford is years of success is maybe a little bit of a aggressive statement, but a guy who I think other NFL teams said, okay, he's going to be our guy who we can fill in with immediately if we have someone get hurt, as opposed to a developmental guy, which I think is what, you know, at this point Rosen still is, because you haven't seen him play well at the NFL level. I absolutely think that once they draft Murray, their leverage with Rosen goes down dramatically. And you have a guy who I think, you know, teams aren't going to be willing to give the same sort of draft compensation for, and you're going to have to wait a year to get that draft compensation. So, I would make the trade now. If I felt like Murray's going to be our guy, I agree with you. I think I would have that trade done by the end of the draft. I'd want to get a guy who's going to contribute to my team this year, whether it's an offensive lineman, whether it's a defensive player, you know, whether it's I don't know what the compensation would be, and I'm going to ask you what you think the compensation would be, but I think that's a trade you want to make now. So, in terms of the compensation, do you think it is the case that they're just holding out for that first round pick and they're not going to make a trade, before, you know, day two of the draft until they have no choice but to accept a second rounder or a third rounder? Or do you think that it's just that they're just holding out for the best possible offer and expecting someone to kind of blow them away?
I think D, all of the above. I think they're just trying to see what they can get. I mean, honestly, I talked to 7 coaches and they told me that, I mean, their opinion was he's worth anything from a 1, simply because he was a 1, to a 5th-round pick.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, the range is incredible. And it really, I mean, this sounds so obvious, but it really just depends on what the team needs. If a team is on the verge of the playoffs and they feel like he could be the missing link, then he's a 1st-round pick. If a team is saying, oh, we can use a backup, he could be a 3rd- or 4th-round pick, maybe a 5th-round pick, or worth of, you know, a 3rd or 5th-round pick. But, you know, I think obviously the Cardinals would love a 1st-round pick in return for him. I think ideally they would love multiple picks in return for him. Will that happen? I don't know. Or if it does happen, is it going to be like maybe a 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and like a 5th, 6th, or 7th? I mean, there's so many options, but I don't know if he's worth a huge package like the actual 1st-round pick is. I think the 1st-round pick is worth a ton simply because of what Kyler Murray has turned into in terms of his stock, the allure of him, all that stuff. But Josh Rosen, I mean, I could see Washington going after him for, you know, a 3rd, 4th, 5th round pick. Miami could be up to offer a couple of picks for him because they need a quarterback. Heck, even the Giants might be willing to trade, you know, a 2nd to 4th round pick for him just to get someone behind Eli at the moment. But I'll be surprised if they get a 1st round pick for him. But at the same time, it wouldn't totally blow me away if it happens.
Right. And, you know, I don't think it's going to be like a top 5 pick. I think if it's going to be a pick in the 1st round, it's going to be, you know, it could be the Patriots, for example, who could say, hey, at 32, we might want a guy to develop behind Tom Brady because we'll know either he's going to play for us or we're going to be able to trade him for a significant compensation, you know, down the line, because we have managed to do that with Jimmy Garoppolo in years past. So it's a really fascinating different situation, because we don't normally see something like this in the NFL, but it's really cool. And maybe cool is the wrong word, because obviously it's Josh Rosen's future and, you know, it has to be upsetting, but it's a really different sort of situation. But Josh, when people want to check out your coverage of that, where can they do that?
On ESPN.com, just go to the Cardinals page or on Twitter at Josh Weinfuss. That's W-E-I-N-F-U-S-S. All your Kyler Murray and Josh Rosen needs.
Well, Josh, thank you so much. We're going to come back with Courtney Cronin after the break here on the Bill Barnwell Show. All right, back here on the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN, and joining me now to talk about the Vikings offseason and specifically a great article she wrote with Rich Cimini of ESPN on the Anthony Barr back and forth with the Jets and the Vikings is ESPN's Courtney Cronin. Courtney, how are you?
I'm well. How are you, Bo?
I am good. I am definitely didn't just get got by a fake Russell Wilson trade story on Twitter, so my heart is totally fine right now.
That's when the fake Schefter account that I had to block several times because it gives me a heart attack every single time I see something, and they managed to keep popping up.
This one was especially bad because it had 72,000 followers, so they paid for followers for a fake NFL Network personality account, which I'm almost impressed by that level of effort to try and make a fake account work. But it got me, so I appreciate that.
Man, quiet lives of desperation is what I call that. So I'm glad that you're still with us after that.
Okay, so real things that have happened over the last few weeks for the Vikings, a very interesting offseason to me in some ways. An offseason that, you know, I don't know about you, but I certainly did not see things going this way in that. Even looking back a couple years ago, you looked at all the young talent the Vikings had, and I always figured, okay, they were going to have to sacrifice one, maybe even two of those guys. It was just going to be too difficult to sign all those guys. And then after they signed Kirk Cousins, I felt, okay, well, absolutely, that is not the case. There's no way they can bring back all that young talent they have on rookie deals. And here we are, and it's April of 2019, and they brought all those guys back. They did lose Sheldon Richardson, but they re-signed Anthony Barr. They extended or gave a new deal to Adam Thielen after his great past couple of years. It's been a really interesting offseason for the Vikings. And let me ask you, are you surprised that we are here and all these guys, again, outside of Richardson, who was on a one-year contract, all these guys are back and on the roster?
In a way, yes. I think the question I get most times from fans on social media is, are the Vikings, you know, are they operating on the same salary cap? Because, you know, they enter free agency with just over $5 million. Or just under $6 million, whichever way you want to look at it. They didn't have a lot of money. They were in the bottom five in the NFL of spending money, and we knew they were going to have to part with a lot of pieces of the roster. I mean, Kirk Cousins' contract handicapped them from the start. This is no surprise that they wouldn't be as active in the first wave and, you know, with the heavy hitters in free agency. It's why they've made so many quiet signings, getting guys from the AAF. You know, just some quieter things here and there. So when I take a look at them being able to get Anthony Barr back after he spurned the Jets last minute and, you know, getting Everson Griffin to take a reduction in salary to stay around another year and Adam Thielen with the extension, we'll soon find out when that money kicks in, but it certainly appears to be something that's going to be kicking in after 2019, just given where they are with their salary cap. It is pretty amazing because they've done some really, you know, technical caponomics type stuff with Rob Brzezinski. You know, he's well revered around the league for some of the things that he's been able to do, especially when finances are so tight in Minnesota. But truly, they've been able to keep their core. You know, despite, you know, as you mentioned, Sheldon Richardson left in free agency, which was, you know, anticipated as we were getting closer to March, and Latavius Murray was gone too, and Nick Easton. You know, several other pieces on the offensive line, Andrew Sandejo, all those things were for them to be able to keep as much as they did is kind of surprising.
Yeah, I mean, certainly a lot of top-level talent on this roster. And like you said, guys did leave Richardson, Easton being, you know, two of the more notables. But, I mean, there's still a lot of guys who not only are really good players, but also guys they drafted and developed. So really, you know, there's a level of familiarity with this team that I think is pretty rare around the NFL. You look at a team like the Patriots, who are, I guess, in a lot of ways, you know, the pinnacle for what the NFL is. And yeah, they kept Tom Brady, they kept Devin McCourty all these years, Rob Gronkowski was on the roster forever, but they lose guys year after year. You're Trey Flowers being the most recent example, where they lose, you know, key guys
Cordero
who are really
Patterson.
Talented football players. Cordarrelle Patterson as well. Yes, yeah. Right up there. One and two, Trey Flowers and then Cordarrelle Patterson. But you know what I mean? Like there's, you know, you're losing a lot of, you know, really talented football players and they've managed to win, obviously, and having Tom Brady helps out, of course. But yeah, I mean, it seems like this is a team now that really is all in with this core of players, at least until, you know, the end of the Kirk Cousins contract.
Yeah, and I think they have to be. They realize what the financial restrictions are when they signed Kurt to that deal in 2018, and that it would make things tricky with the cap, and that you have to hit on guys in the draft, and mm-hmm. you have to go to the bargain bin for everything else that you can't get in free agency. Their big free agency signing was Anthony Barr, was being able to retain him at a mm-hmm. much reduced rate with guarantees significantly less than what he would have been making with the Jets. Mm-hmm. And that was their prerogative. They went really heavy on defense this offseason, from Barr to Griffin, and then they've been able to get, you know, several different defensive backs from the AAF. And I realized, yes, it's the AAF. Do we know if they're going to be able to pan out, or if these guys are just bodies on a 90-man roster? We shall see. But when you take a look at the move that they've made and how that will structure what they can do in the draft, all signs point to offense, at least initially, with what they do at 18. Certainly the offensive line is the area that most fans want to see them address and address early, potentially even often, maybe, you know, with two of those first three picks that they have. But even still, they signed Josh Klein. He was one of the bigger free agent signings behind Anthony Barr, and that's what you're calling a big free agency mm-hmm. signing. I mean, he's, you know, one of the second, third wave type guards who, you know, has a lot of starts to his name. I think he's, you know, got the most starts, most consecutive starts at right guard of anybody playing currently, mm-hmm. but, you know, not a top tier starter. So they got him. So, I mean, they were able to fill some holes, but it's certainly an area that needs to have some work continue to be done during mm-hmm. the draft. And I also think that there's some skill positions that you don't want to neglect, you know, in a couple weeks with, you know, the wide receiver position, tight end. I mean, those are definitely some mid-round guys out there that the Vikings could look to fill their roster out with. But it's going to be interesting to see, since they went so heavy with defense this offseason, if we mm-hmm. see in, you know, a heavy load of offensive players, you know, in the mix in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting position on that. It feels like, and maybe you would know much better than I would, given that you're so close to the organization here, you know, just given that it feels like the offensive line is a problem one way or another every single year. And if you ask Vikings fans, whenever I write about the Vikings, whenever I tweet about the Vikings, if it's not about the offensive line, the replies are always about the offensive line. And you mentioned Josh Klein, and he is a serviceable guard, a good run blocker, someone who, granted, last year, you know, after one season into his extension in Tennessee, they decided they wanted to move on from him. They upgraded by signing Roger Saffold, I believe. And but at the same time, I mean, the Vikings didn't, it's not like they had the guys they had last year and they're bringing in Klein to supplement them. They lost Easton. They lost Mike Remmers. So they got rid of Mike Remmers. They got rid of Tom Compton. Not that those guys were necessarily great football players, but they were playing meaningful snaps for the Vikings. So, you know.
Yeah, they were bodies.
Right, they were bodies. And even if they weren't star bodies, they were at least, you know, they were better than the guys who were on the bench who are now, theoretically at least until this draft, are going to be in meaningful roles. So it seems like, you know, it almost feels like they have to use one of those picks, one of those top two picks on offensive linemen. And so what I'm going to ask you is this. Do you think that the organization internally, do you think they see the offensive line as much of a problem as the fans do outside the organization?
I do, because if you look at the paper trail here of everybody who's taken visits, prospect visits over the last month and a half, the Vikings have hosted, to my count, 14 offensive tackles alone. That's, I think, more than anybody else in the NFL. That's a high number. So they've been bringing guys in. They're clearly trying to find some sort of fit. Does that maybe signify that Riley Reiff could be moving from left tackle to left guard, or might be Brian O'Neill moving around? I don't know yet. I think that's too early to tell, but certainly the number of linemen, particularly tackles, that they're focused on in the pre-draft process should allude to the fact that, yes, they know this is an area it needs to be upgraded. I'm sure Gary Kubiak's influence on this offense and really trying to create that zone blocking scheme that they they struggled with last year is certainly a huge part of that, because they know what they need to do to be a better run, you know, better run blocking team, better pass blocking team. And we talk about so much with Mike Zimmer wanting to run the ball, run the ball, run the ball. And yes, you have to be effective and do both. Pass blocking was an issue. Kirk Cousins was sacked a lot. I mean, granted, some of that is his fault for holding onto the ball too long and just his overall pocket awareness and presence. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's twofold. They really have to, like, kind of redo the entire offensive line, not saying cut it down to the studs, because there's really not that much left to do in terms of, you know, just personnel. I don't think if you get rid of anybody else, I think you're in a good spot now To build some depth and possibly even find your day one starter at left guard. Or, you know, if you do really think that Pat Elflein should be moving back to a guard spot, you draft a center with your first pick.
Yeah, I think both those, whether left guard or center, both those opportunities are in play, or left tackle, like you said, if they move Riley Reiff inside. You mentioned Gary Kubiak, and it's an interesting situation. Obviously, they brought back Kevin Stefanski, who was the offensive coordinator at the end of last season, talked to Cleveland about their head coaching job, ended up staying in Minneapolis, and then Kubiak comes in as a, what is his actual title, Kubiak?
It's an associate head coach and offensive advisor.
So an advisor. Interesting role.
An advisor, yeah.
Yeah. So how do you
He will not be calling plays on game day. That's as far as we know. One of the first questions he was asked back in January that, no, he is not calling plays. He will be in the booth, and Kevin Stefanski will be on the field calling plays. So as far as we know, Stefanski's still calling plays. He is offensive coordinator, but Gary Kubiak has, you know, a huge emphasis in part in what's going to make this offense run.
Yeah, I guess that's the interesting part to me in that, you don't really see that very frequently where you have a relatively inexperienced coordinator. We don't know a lot about Kevin Stefanski. He's only been the coordinator for a few games. And then you have this veteran guy who's been a head coach in the past, sort of in an advisory role. And the only situation I could think of recently where that was comparable was actually in Kansas City, where you had Brad Childress, of course, the former Vikings head coach, as the spread game coordinator, I think.
Yeah.
He was in a role that was sort of, he was there, but he wasn't playing a regular role in relation to their offensive coordinators, who were Brad Childress. Doug Peterson, excuse me, the guy who won the Super Bowl last year. I should remember his name, but Doug Peterson was a relatively inexperienced offensive coordinator, and then Matt Nagy was a relatively inexperienced offensive coordinator before Childress went to Chicago with Nagy. Do you think the Kubiak thing is something where by the end of the year he could have a larger role? Do you think it's something where, he wants to have a relatively limited role? Like how do you see that sort of interaction happening over the course of the season?
Well, it's really interesting. In spending some time with Mike Zimmer this offseason, I was with him at owners' meeting. We were just chatting one-on-one about, the process of how this offense is being built. And, to hear him so excited about the offensive process, this is really his only time all year that he's able to dive, headfirst into it. Because, as a head coach, during the week, during the install, during game day, there's only so much you can do. You can sit in on a few meetings. You can have a meeting with your quarterback every once in a while. But that defense is his baby. He's what makes that defense run. So he needs to be able to trust whoever is in that offensive meeting room is going to be on the same page with him and also keep him abreast of things that are going on. So I think for him, you heard him at the combine talk about how fascinated he was hearing Kubiak talk, because they're, kind of about the same age. They've been around some of the same people. But to hear the evolution of the West Coast system from the Bill Walshes to, the Shanahan family to where it's at now and with Kubiak and his influence and what they're trying to do here, he's waxing poetic about it. And it was, nice to see, just how he kind of lit up about it, because he was so excited about what's being built in his meeting rooms at TCO Performance Center. So I think with a guy like Gary Kubiak, he doesn't want to be a head coach again. He said that. Whether that pans out, I guess, remains to be seen. But I could see him, I don't know if he wants to go back to being an offensive coordinator. I think, the guy's won Super Bowls. He's been to Super Bowls as a player, obviously in a backup role behind John Elway. But he has the experience. I don't know what more, since he's been out of coaching for 2 years. He was, in the scouting role with Denver for a while, and now he's back and he's brought his guys with him, and Brian Perriani, Rick Dennison, and his son Clint Kubiak, who's the quarterback's coach. I think that you might see this kind of tandem stay in Minnesota if it continues to work, and maybe he's happy in his advisory role. Maybe eventually that morphs to where he's calling plays. I'm not exactly sure. But I do think that this is going to be a test for him, because it kind of lets him get back into coaching without having to do, the daily grind and all that stuff. I mean, he's still going to be working. He's part of the game plan. You're part of the install, but you're not doing every single thing hands-on. You're advising. You're you know, the leadership voice for a young offensive coordinator. I think that's incredibly beneficial. It's something that Kevin Stefanski says he was a part of in terms of the hiring process and wanted to bring Kubiak here. Mm-hmm. So that's a really good sign. But yeah, I mean, I think there's an itch still with Yuri Kubiak that he still wants to be part of this in a coaching role, but not in a coaching role, if that makes any sense whatsoever. Kind of the maybe he found the happy medium here. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he might not know either. It might, you know, might get to week six or week seven, and he might say, hey, you know, like I love this, but I want to have a bigger role. So it's going to be a really interesting few weeks to see how the offense ends up splitting up there. Finishing up with the defense here, I mentioned the Barr story. Great piece. Everyone should go read that at ESPN.
Thank you.
In terms of Barr's motivations, given that it's been such a, you know, at times an up and down sort of run for him in Minnesota, where he's been, you know, sort of treated as a, you know, he's made multiple Pro Bowls. He's a great player in so many ways, but there have been times where he's been very frustrating, where Mike Zimmer has called him out publicly. Were you surprised there was so much of a pull on Barr to come back to Minnesota?
Yes and no, because for a while it felt like he was wearing a sign on his forehead that said, I want to be a 3-4 outside rushing linebacker, the outside linebacker who rushes the passer. I want to be that. I mean, he's made comments about it, and it was kind of, you wondered at points last year, considering all offseason and during training camp, he was working with the pass rushers, he was getting some work in with Andre Patterson in the defensive line. Okay, well, when is this going to happen? Well, he gets hurt, embarrassed on national TV in that LA game, which, you know, as Mike Zimmer said, that wasn't as much, you know, with him as it was with the schematical things that, you know, Sean McVay was doing by putting slot receivers on him. So, you know, we really didn't see Anthony Barr, the pass rusher, until late in the season because he had the hamstring injury, he was out for 3 games, and it was very much an up and down year. But towards the end of the year, you saw him line up, you know, against tackles, and he did pretty well. I mean, I think that to me, I was like, okay, does he actually want to do this full time, where it's not just in a situational role on third down, where in a 3-4, is that your best fit? And you can make more money doing it. But I think he likes what Mike Zimmer has laid out for him in this really versatile role, where sometimes you're going to be like a defense, you're built like a defensive end, so sometimes you're going to be a defensive end, prototype rushing the passer, and sometimes you're going to be tasked with, you know, dropping back and covering the back end like a safety. Like 2015 Anthony Barr is the best Anthony Barr that the Vikings have seen, and if he can get back to that role, which I think is going to be really interesting, because we asked Mike Zimmer about this at owners' meetings a few weeks ago, and he said that, you know, quote, out-of-the-box ideas, that's what they're going to be. There's a lot of out-of-the-box stuff that they're going to be doing on defense this year. And it's kind of similar to what, you know, he relayed last year, and they actually had to go back to the drawing board because they said they overcomplicated and overthought some things early on, going when the, you know, kind of the bottom fell out for the defense in week 4 in that Los Angeles loss to the Rams. But, you know, I think Barr is a big part of that, because you wonder, okay, what is Everson Griffin's role going to become? I mean, yes, he did come back, restructured his deal, and was able to, you know, remain with a team that he's comfortable with. He knows the system, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, what is his role? Is he morphing into a situational pass rusher? Where can Anthony Barr fit the mix there? For me, it was surprising just in terms of how much money he left on the table. And just because it doesn't seem like he and Mike Zimmer were always seeing eye to eye, as every player, you know, kind of preps themselves, okay, free agency is something you want to get to, that's where you make your big money, but Anthony showed that sometimes it truly isn't all about that. You know, there's no guaranteed contracts except for a few in the NFL. I really liked what his agent told him, that's in the story, that, you know, I want you to be in a place where you're comfortable, where you feel like this is the best fit, and not be worried about making, you know, an extra $10 to $15 million that truly you might not even get on the later part of your deal. So he's in a place where he's happy. He's in a place where he's valued. He's a core player of this, core member of this defense, key player in the locker room. He's well respected. I mean, Mike Zimmer and him may have some public spats and arguments, and he called him out for coasting a few years ago. But let's not forget, during training camp, Mike Zimmer was addressing fake trade rumors and called his own press conference to let everybody know that the fake trade rumors that were out there, which we still don't know where they came from, about Anthony Barr being traded, were unequivocally not true, is what he said last year. So, I mean, this is his guy. It's the first player he drafted in Minnesota. He took somebody out of position because he saw potential for him in this 4-3 outside linebacker roles with what he's done the last few years. And he's gotten the most out of Barr. And I think that sometimes the fit and being able to, you know, project your career longevity even longer is more than just is better for a lot of players than chasing a payday.
Yeah, makes total sense. Well, Courtney, if people want to check out more of your work covering the Vikings, where can they do that?
They can either go to ESPN.com and click over onto the Vikings tab on the NFL page, or you can follow me on Twitter at Courtney R. Cronin.
Awesome. Well, Courtney, thank you so much, and we'll have you back on during the year to talk more Vikings.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Thanks, Bill.
All right, thanks so much to my guests today, ESPN's Josh Weinfuss and Courtney Cronin. By the way, guys, I've been telling you this every week. If you haven't listened to me yet, I don't know why, but I'm going to keep reminding you until you do it. You need to listen to the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny. This week, Mina looks ahead to the NFL draft with ESPN front office insider Lewis Riddick. Now, we already know Lewis is a genius, but just as a reminder, 2 years ago, Lewis predicted a second-year leap for Jared Goff, and last year, he predicted the success of Patrick Mahomes. Pretty decent success rate there. Who's it going to be this year? You can find out by downloading and subscribing to the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks so much for listening to my show, The Bill Barnwell Show, and we have more audio coming for you next week.